Clint Barton, aka Hawkeye, became the greatest sharpshooter known to man. He then joined the Avengers. This is what he does when he's not being an Avenger. I'm Eddie Webb, and today we talk about issues 13 through 16, as well as issue 18 of Hawkeye here on Speechless. Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Speechless. I'm still making my way through the Matt Fraction, Dave Aja run of Hawkeye from 2012. And we have 5 issues to get through, so we're going to kind of dive right into it. First, we're going to start off with issue 13, which is The You in Funeral, written by Matt Fraction, drawn by David Aja, color artist Matt Hollingsworth, and lettered by Chris Lipiolis. And we start off with Clint in the hospital with the three women that we saw dealing with him back a couple issues ago, back in issue 11. That Spider Girl or Spider Woman, Red Widow, Black Spider Woman, Black Widow, and Mockingbird, and they're all looking at him, annoyed, outraged, and then finally. Mockingbird says, you know, about his sidekick. He's like, I don't have a sidekick. And it's like, Bishop, something happened to Bishop. And he finds out that something has gone wrong with Kate. And so we cut to the roof, and Clint finally sees the murder scene of Gil. So he's finally up to date on what happened. And he recognizes that this is happened as a result for him. And actually, I should at this point note that it's a really interesting choice. I talked before about how David Aja has some really amazing layout. This is generally a pretty somber story in a lot of ways. And what's fascinating is that the entire issue, David Aja does a 9-panel layout, which is extremely classic comic book layout. But the even with traditional classic comics, they weren't all on a grid like this. Sometimes, you know, they would put 2 panels together, so it'd be slightly larger. I mean, it's still on a grid, but the actual panels would sometimes change size or combine to give a little sense of movement. This is purely a grid. It's the same 9 panel grid throughout the entire issue. So it's interesting that by completely not providing innovative layout, we're again telling a little bit of a story through layout. This is a story of Clint going through the motions, as we'll see. So we cut to Clint kind of watching TV on the couch, drinking beer when the phone rings. And it's Barney calling him, and we see the other side of the call that Barney made for the telephone booth a few issues back. It's like he picks it up and he goes, "What?" And then he goes, "Ha ha, hey Barn," because in Barney's side of the conversation was, "Hey, guess what, chicken butt." So when it's a joke that you have to read both issues and remember both issues to get the actual joke. It's not a very good joke, but it's an interesting technique, right? It requires the reader to remember previous issues, but there's enough context in both one-sided conversations that you don't have to remember them to understand what's being said. You just get an additional level of enjoyment out of remembering both sides of the conversation and comparing the two. But, you know, it's still like, you know, hey, you got back in town. What do you need? Yeah, call back tomorrow. And this is the point where Clint says, come back, you know, 9:10. Because remember, Barney in the previous issue had said, "Did you mean AM or PM?" And this is where we get that line payoff. And it ends with Barney futzing Barton. So we're definitely getting the sense that they have an estranged relationship. Then we cut to Clint waking up to 2 cops showing up, asking if he's the superintendent of the building. And he's like, "Yes, I'm the acting interim candidate ownership guy." And Clint makes coffee. And now we're seeing the scene from when Pizza Dog had his issue, and we saw Clint talking to cops. We understand the full context of the issue. We're now getting that full conversation. And basically, they're investigating the murder on the rooftop. So they're asking questions like, anyone come on the roof? Where were you at the time? You know, asking where he was. He was talking to his ex-wife on the phone. And this is a funny gag. It's like, I was calling my wife, ex-wife. It's like, you know, yeah, she's a mentor too. I had a spelling question. It's like, a spelling question? It's like, yeah, like I said, I had a few drinks. So Clint is not not always a great person. And this one thing that I love about this series is that he is a hero. He's unabashedly, undeniably a hero, but he's also not always a good man. And so it's great how this series continually kind of reinforces that he's just not even a jerk. He just doesn't think about other people all the time. And he does things like call his ex-wife at 3 a.m, how to spell something after he's been drunk. But then it ends with him looking down saying good boy to Lucky, which is again the only dialogue we saw of this scene previously that was comprehensible. So then Clint takes a cab to Rockaway Beach, where he hugs Gil's father. Then we see the funeral set up, and again, this is another scene we saw from Lucky's perspective. And they're talking about collar stays and what the collar stays are, because Clint has no clue. This is where Kate decides that, you know, I'm here for you. You could let me know anything. You could tell me what you want. Let them all come. And it turns out that Clint's asleep, misses the whole conversation with Kate. Again, reinforcing Clint's just kind of self-absorbed at times. He has a nightmare where he's walking into the flooding basement that we saw at Gil's house, but it's all red, and eventually sees Gil. You know, we're all down here, Hawkeye. They arrive at the funeral, and at the funeral, the Tracksuit Mafia are actually watching Gil's funeral. And a couple of the goons are saying, you know, we could kill him right now. You know, just down, pow, pow, pow. And the leader in the white tracksuit is like, shut up. And they talk about how Kazi is knows what he's doing. And we see a cut to Kazi also there at the funeral. Then Clint goes back home. Phone rings again. And again, we see the other half of the second conversation with Bernie. At night, it always being night. So Barney shows up, they hug, and then we get the conversation where Kate decides to go from to Los Angeles, but we see it from Barney's perspective. He's in the bathroom, and she's hearing it through the bathroom door, and then as Barney kind of comes in, Kate's already gone, and Clint's outside the building, and so took my dog. And Barnaby's comment of, well, actually, I don't know, looks like the dog left to me. So there's another party on the rooftop. Only this time, Gil's dad is the one that's really grilling the hot dogs. And Clint introduces everyone to Barney, Barney to everyone. And they say, welcome to the family. So, and Barney's confused. And that's the end of the issue. So, this is an interesting issue, 13, because it's taking a lot of the bits and pieces we've seen over the past several issues and kind of pulls back and gives them all in a different context from Clint's perspective. It's a lot of small random things, and yet it cohesively holds together. Because this is a quieter issue. We don't have any action. It's just kind of Clint's going through, but also he's kind of going through the motions. He's just going from one thing to the next, and he never really has any strong emotion throughout this whole issue. He just kind of is in shock from everything, from basically finding out Gil's dead on. And even though we are seeing the other side of several scenes, it's not filler. Like, there's a very distinct arc here. It's from Clint discovering that Gil is dead and his guilt over that to going to the funeral. And Gil's father, who was feeling kind of alone after his wife's death, now becoming part of their found family with the building crew. So it's definitely an issue that needs the rest of the series for context, but it's still just a really great issue. And again, I can't overstate, like, even the subtle change, like just making it a very staid layout, adds some text and depth to it. And then we go on to issue 14, LA Woman, which is written by Matt Fraction, art by Annie Wu, color artist is Matt Hollingsworth, and lettered by Chris Iliopoulos. And we have Kate doing yoga on top of a trailer park before she goes shopping. And she's clearly struggling to find work. Like, she gets a whole bunch of food, and it's like $87, and then we're down to just like cat food and cauliflower or dog food and cauliflower, and it's like, you know, $4.17. So she's struggling to find work. She puts out a hero for hire ad that she prints up to, you know, little tearaway strips and who to call and how to call. And then she realizes she doesn't have a printer. So she actually knocks on the door of one of the trailers on the beach she's on and actually has to borrow the printer. It's two men of color. And they are married, and they're talking about that someone stole orchids to get the wedding to be ruined because these orchids aren't there. And Kate's like, "Hey, I can offer to be a help." And it's like, "What's skinny worker?" It's like, "I'm an Avenger." And so they're going, and we cut to her just being on a bicycle. It's like, "I'm on the case." And she goes to the flower shop where there was clearly a break-in. The florist has a black eye sitting on the front stoop. The window's broken in, and how everything is ruins. And they keep talking about how the clients had a vision of this wedding. The vision is ruined because these orchids are gone. And I mean, I wanted them to have something rare and beautiful and as patient as they were. And that's one of the reasons why the orchids were so important, because I have learned that growing orchids is a very careful process. Orchids can go bad so easily. So you have to be extremely patient when growing orchids. So it made sense that this is the flower they wanted to kind of celebrate that relationship. And they said that someone named Flint Ward came in, and he looked like he burned the place down. And so she goes to the police station. She talks to Detective Caudill. And so she's like, "I have questions about Flint Ward." He's like, "Who the hell are you?" And he's like, she's introduced herself. And he's like, "The investigation's ongoing." And she's trying to be a detective. Like, you know, "Do you have any leads?" And he's like, "Well, it's pretty clearly arson. Who the hell are you?" And it's like, "Yeah, I'm Kate Bishop." It's like, "What is that to me?" He basically just blows her off. And the main thing he has to go and does is force one of press charges. And he doesn't. So he's like, "Well, cool, then we're done. Have a nice day." She's goes back and tries to talk to the couple. It's like, "I'm going to go talk to this Flint Ward." And they're like, "We just don't want any trouble. We just want our flowers back. But I had, you know, I had a vision. I know it's silly, but I had a vision." And she's like, "No, I'm going to take the case." And she's like, "You know, are you a private detective?" Like, "Better, I'm a superhero." And then we cut to Kate trying to use her computer to research how to become a private detective. And there's this great visual of different search bars overlapping each other, and so it's private detective evidence, arson law, arson, how to be a private detective in California. And finally, it just ends with like a whole bunch of just random key presses as she slams her face into the keyboard. So it's a nice way of showing through action all the kind of just, you know, almost in one panel. She approaches Officer Caudill again, and he's just outraged. Like, "When you're interfering, this is an ongoing investigation. People are trained in law to enforce those laws. Just knock it off." And it's it's an interesting moment because at the first time I read this, I was like, what is happening? Why is there this kind of weird, kind of low rent private eye story happening? But it's an interesting conversation because what Kate is doing, she's approaching this problem as a superhero. And there's a certain set of tropes and expectations that come with superheroism that when confronted in a situation we don't have like the Avengers as backup or a previous relationship with a superhero, just don't make sense. It's like you are an untrained, unqualified teenager coming in and messing with an active police investigation with people who are trained to do this. So it's an interesting, it's not quite a deconstruction of the superhero dynamic, but certainly it is poking at it and going, this actually, if you think about it, this doesn't really make sense. And Kate's kind of running into that frustration, particularly because, not to be too fine point on it, she is a woman of privilege. She is a rich woman. She is a white woman. She is used to things going her way. And she is struggling when things aren't just naturally falling into place for her. Some of that is on Kate Bishop, but I think it's fair to say that some of that comes from her identity. She's never had to encounter these things before, and now she's being forced to do things like finding the right kind of cat food. In the grocery store, she runs into a guy in a trench coat who talks to her about cat food and makes some kind of metaphor about like if he, you know, she can't find the right cat food, and so he digs way back in the shelf and finds the one with the green label because cat only likes the green label and all the blue labels in. And they talk a little bit about cats and they kind of like, you know, you kind of learn after a while if you don't give up, you can find what you need. And she points out this is a metaphor for my life right now. And he just kind of leaves. He just kind of leaves at that point. You don't know his name. Kate dresses up to the best of her ability, which basically amounts to a hat and sunglasses. And she bikes up to Flint Ward's house. And she's like just bad at this. She's like, you know, I must see you in the market for certain orchids, in quotes. And he's just like, I beg your pardon? And so she tries to bluff her way in and fails. He's like, I don't sell my orchids to weird women in bike shorts that appear on my doorstep. That was plan A. She couldn't get in. So plan B is she dresses up and breaks in because that's what you do. She makes the comment that this really should have been plan A all along. In fact, in future, I'm just going to auto-scrap plan A, which is funny, but also valid because I know from experience as a professional creative that a lot of times your first ideas are in fact actually not great, and you probably want to write those ideas down just to get rid of them. So usually your first idea is never always the best idea. You want to usually brainstorm and find some more ideas. So it was like a bit of like, yeah, that's actually a valid point. So she breaks into a greenhouse and she finds an orchid, and there's a whole bunch of the bellboys sitting around playing cards. And the bellboys, if you remember, were the ones that worked with Madame Mask and assaulted her when she confronted Madame Mask the second time. And so they all pull out guns and start to, you know, threaten, you know, we're going to help this guest check out a bunch of really bad puns. And then she finally pulls her bow and arrow and says, oh, thank God, I was starting to forget how to use this. And so we get into, it looks like it's going to get into a fight. She grabs the orchid and they run, and she bounces off of another, bellboy. She sees little tiny little Hawkeye heads over her instead of birds, which is a cute little moment. And they throw her out. And so she has no flower and she's been kicked out. And now she gets charged with trespassing and harassment. So she goes back to the grocery store, and so she runs into the strange guy with the trench coat again. And it's like, and he just starts giving her more explicit advice. It's not even coded as a cat food metaphor anymore. It's just, at my best, I'm borderline, but if we're no better than them, then we're no better than them. And she's like, he says, do better, be better. And so she goes after him again. And this time, she starts steadily getting information, taking pictures of where he goes, following his car, until she gets caught. And so she's trying to pedal away from him as he drives her down in her car, but he assaults her, you know, basically knocks her off the car, and she takes a picture of him having done that. So now she's in the hospital with an arm in her sling, and the detective comes up, and she starts giving him all the information. And he's talking about how his tag is Weed Lord. This guy is apparently also a drug dealer on the side. He sells weed. And the detective correctly points out, it's legal here. He has cards and papers and everything. But the hit and run is a felony, and he had a gun on top of it. And he talks about Penal Code 12022.53, use a gun and you're done. Which, as I understand, is actually a legal California code. So he was actually completely in the right until Kate pissed him off so much that he ended up committing a crime, which unveiled a bigger crime. And so we cut to the wedding. This is between Marcus and I forget what his husband's name is. Kate shows up totally injured, carrying the orchid so that Marcus can have that perfect vision of his wedding. We go to the store again, or the grocery store again, see the guy in the trench coat, which looks a lot like Columbo. I forgot to mention that, but he's clearly meant to be a Peter Falk homage. He's like, you took a liberty, you have some files and some index cards, to kind of help her with her case. And then she's like, you know what? Actually, I don't really, thank you so much. I actually don't really know your name. And then he's gone. So she's like, excuse me, there's a guy with a trench coat. Where is he at? And it's like, you've been the only person here for the last half hour. It very much implies that either he's not real or maybe he has some kind of powers, but certainly there's something odd about this guy in his trench coat. Ward's in jail. He gets let out, and he's talking to someone. I found her. She got me arrested, but I found her. I tried running her over. I've been frustrating, so I thought you should know. And then it turns out he's talking to Madame Mask, which is not a huge surprise, because if he had bellboys there to help him with his criminal activities, there's probably some connection with Madame Mask. But of course, she's definitely she's in a bath, which is covered in orchids, and so they've been thinking the reason why the orchids were stolen was for her bath. They're going to threaten Kate. So that's issue 14. Issue 15, which is Fun and Games, written by Matt Fraction, artist by David Aja, color artist Matt Hollingsworth, and letterers by Chris Leopoulos. And I mentioned this before, but we're now at the stage of the comic where we're moving back and forth between Clint and Kate. So right now, all of the odd-numbered issues are Clint. All of the even-numbered issues are Kate. So we're back to Clint. The ongoing joke, this is a great, actually, moment in exploring humor. I mentioned way back in episode one about how I did the "Okay, this looks bad" gimmick. You start off every issue with "Okay, this looks bad." This looks really bad. This looks very bad. And that it's a good way to the first part of humor is like you want to set the scene and then kind of reinforce it, tweak it a little bit, but you want to reinforce the gag. So he did that. It's like going slight changes to the form of like, okay, this is bad, and then put it in slightly different contexts, give it texture. But the first three issues, setting that line up. After a while, it's okay, this looks, and then kind of just drop it. Or we'll move the "this looks bad" line to later in the book. So we're giving increasingly different contexts. But then we actually haven't had it for several issues. But this issue opens up, okay, this looks, and then changes to completely ridiculous as we cut to a picture of Clint with his pants down, his hands up, being held at gunpoint next to a fan. So by changing the line to completely ridiculous, it's like we're expecting a certain payoff, and then it actually becomes a different payoff. And because we haven't seen it in a while, it's fresh again. So it's a great way to kind of show payoffs for a comic. It's like if you make a joke, you can call back to it quickly, and then you have to lengthen the callback before you call back to it again. And usually you want to give a slightly different context for that callback. And you can do it one more time, after people have almost forgotten the gag, you can call back to it one more time. So there's almost kind of like an increasing larger cycle for callbacks when you do comedy. And this is a great example of that. The Tracksuit Mafia have masks on and they have them at gunpoint. And he's like, you know, can I pull up my drawers first? And they're like, no. And he's like, you want to see a magic trick? And then we cut to earlier, where Clint is doing a crossword puzzle, which is the 5, 6, 7 letters, starts with B, ends with E, all the stuff you take with you, and the word is baggage, which is, because he's talking to his ex-wife, it's like, okay, haha, it's a subtle reference to the relationship they have. But it also plays back to why Clint was calling his ex-wife with a spelling problem earlier, because apparently he does crosswords, and she is the person he calls when he has a problem with crosswords. And so we see him trying to tie his pants up, and he mentioned that he broke his belt. So we're going to see what's going on. And then we cut to realizing that it's not Clint asking about the crossword puzzle, it's actually Barney. Clint is trying to get his pants fixed, but Mockingbird is there. During all of this, Barney is reading out a clue and then writing down the answer, and it's some kind of commentary on the ongoing conversation. But there's a lot of discussion here. So kind of skim through it. We find that the main kind of tracksuit guy, not the one in the white outfit, but there's been a bold one with mustache we've seen pretty regularly. Apparently his name is Ivan Banionis. And he's the one that, like, Clint originally bought the thing from. The one that was next to the tracksuit guy who owns Arrow, and it was Lucky. And they find out he's buying cities all over the place, all over the block, except for the building they're in. So it looks like they're trying to get control of this entire area, and this building is right in the middle of this whole area they're trying to control. So we cut back to Clint's being held at gunpoint, and it's like, you know, just say the magic word, and they're like, well, is it abracadabra? Say the magic word, it's Barney. It's like, what Barney? It's like, just say Barney. It's like, no, come on. Say Barney. And they're like, Barney. It's like, no, you have to just say it. My pants are down. Come on. You got to really shout it. And so they shout the word Barney, and then Barney leaps in and attacks them. Again, reestablished earlier there, Barney's actually the person who taught Clint how to fist fight. And so they beat up the mafia, and then, of course, at the end, Clint, holding up his pants, goes, ta-da, as they're all unconscious. Now we have Barney and Clint talking to Natasha, again, the second of the women in Clint's life. Barney's still doing crossword puzzles, but she gives Clint a dossier on Kazi. And they're meeting in a diner. And she's giving more information on Kazi and about his hitman. And really just getting quietly reiterating in case people have missed previous issues, but this is all material that we more or less know. Maybe give a little more context for it, but generally he is a well-known assassin. Things that were said between the lines in previous issues are now being – the subtext is being made text in this issue always. Kazi's in a meeting where they talk about – there's this large facility. It's a premier luxury shopping destination they want to make. And it's a 3-block by 3-block parcel of land. And so we get the context of this is why they want to buy this land, is to build this experience. We had everything handled. We have contractors ready to go. We have unions have been a problem. Eventually, it looks like Kazi's actually a businessman, and we talked about earlier that he had some kind of other job, and apparently this is part of his other job. But he talks about how he'll take care of the problem. We see Clint's, his pants fall down as the guy shows. Now we're caught up to the start of the issue, they're trying to get him into the van. And then as they go away from that, because we know the resolution of that, Kazi, now in his clown makeup. Let's talk about how it's Clint's position when he's asked by the police what his role was. And he's like, I don't know who I am. He points out that it's illegal. Effectively everyone in the building is squatting at this point. So that the idea that they had to be cautious about this actually goes out the window because they actually believe they have the law on their side. So he can't call the cops if they decide to go in hard, which is what they plan to do. So after the aftermath of beating up the Traxxas Mafia, it turned out some of them, that was a distraction while some of them were actually in the building starting to abduct the various people to get Clint's attention into the building. And so he and Barney start to deal with them. He shoots some of the guns out of people's hands. Simone, the woman with the two kids, is screaming. One of them holds a kid at gunpoint, and Barney crashes through a window, grabs the guy from behind to save the kids. And he's like, are you guys okay? And Barney's trying to be cool. It's like, our guests didn't, guess you could say those guys really, they really, those two guys, and I threw him off the fire escape. So he's trying to do a funny line because he thinks what superheroes do, and he just can't. He's like, I just threw him off the fire escape. And so then we cut to Barney, Simone, her two kids, and Clint are now talking to Spider-Woman, the third woman in his life. Again, we can go back through him, the different relationships he has. And he's like, you can't call the cops. You can't not call the cops just because you think you could just call the Avengers and skate on good intentions. He's like, but I did the right thing. I'm going to do the right thing. And Jess is pointing out it's not that simple. And he's like, maybe it should be. And then Barney's like, so how'd they get in? Have you ever thought about that? We had the place on lockdown. You had two guys in back. And then we had the door covered. So how'd they actually get in? And he realized that Matchy might still be inside. But we see a cut of an old woman opening the exit door, and we remember that Kazi knows an old woman inside this building, and some of the Traxxas Mafia also know an old woman, so they actually have someone working in the inside. So Clint's like, oh, crap, it's too late, and tries to rush and find, and Kazi is actually holding an arrow in his hand by a door as Clint barrels through, and then Kazi stabs Clint through the ears with the arrow and then shoots him. And he runs as Jess comes down the stairs and sees that both Barney and – I'm sorry, he shoots Barney. He stabs Clint through the ears and shoots Barney. She comes down to see that both Barney and Clint are damaged on a checkerboard floor. And that is the end of issue 15. This issue 15 leads directly into issue 19. Which I'll cover next episode. And the one I've been saying, like, this is the issue that's important to me. So this is the setup for issue 19. But we're going to not get to that this episode because we have two more Kate issues, 16 and 18. And remember, 17 was the issue that we looked at where Clint fell asleep, and that was the kind of fill-in issue to help out David Aja's schedule. So I was right in the sense that that was put in there to give him time. What I forgot to mention is that there were actually two Andy Wu issues on either side of that. So it's actually issue 19 that he needed the extra time on. So we're getting there, I promise. Episode 5. And I'm hoping I'm not building this issue up too much, but it is a very important issue to me. And this is really like the peak of the story for me. But we're not there yet. Instead, we're going to go on to issue 16, which is recording tape. Written by Matt Fraction, art by Andy Wu, color by Matt Hollingsworth, and lettered by Chris Olibiolis. And actually, that's the creative team for both issues, so I'll probably just do 16 and 18 together because they do tie together. And this is Kate's second case. And it's about a singer. And it really goes into the role of the music industry in Los Angeles and some of the mythology is built up around it. So we see a man who's in a recording studio just covered in microphones. He's playing at a piano. He's wearing a robe, but there are microphones everywhere. And we see someone inside, fall out note, crank every mic and record everything every second. I want to hear the air die. And the man at the piano is smiling, and then finally he cries and says, I'm done. I think I'm done. And then we cut to what appears to be 46 years later. We see the same man now in a beard, staring, wandering in the middle of traffic where cars honking all around him. And she makes a comment, Los Angeles isn't big into sharing the road or anything, not in a car, which is really true. LA traffic is awful. But she's on her bike and she sees this man walking and he's talking about how it's all gone. It's all stolen. And she's like, can I get you, a bottle of water or something? And he's like, no. And it's like, and she's like, I'm sorry. I just, tell me what was stolen from you. And maybe will you pay me if I got it back? And so we find out that the man's name is Will Brayson. And she's actually talking to her two neighbors, the ones that she helped the wedding for. And they find out that he's Will Brayson. And she's like, who? She's like, Will Brayson. Will Brayson apparently was a singer in the 60s. He and his brother, Gray, were the Brayson brothers. And they were the California Sound before there was a California Sound. So basically, this was kind of an early 60s doo-wop harmony white soul band. What happened was what got stolen was his wish, and it's not wish, is actually a record he could never finish. It was supposed to be his big masterpiece, and it became this mythological thing in the LA music scene of where musicians would play sessions in studios without knowing the context for the song. There were supposedly live secret shows of people wearing masks, and it just came out. They were just making music and just making it and making it and making it and making it and making it. So much of it. Eventually, someone knocks the door, and a couple of men in white coats arrive and say, hey, we understand Miss Brayson here. Brayson mentions that Gray's going to punish him and tell everyone that he's unwell. They take him back in a white Hummer. Kate's like, you can't take him. It's like, he needs to be sedated. He needs to be taken care of. But it's all done in a very suspicious way. And so finally she's like, I smell a case. And so she goes to the library and she finds the internet. And she's like, being a detective is the worst. Computers are the worst. Being a private detective is the worst because I have to do this research. And it's funny because, like, again, there's this ideal that I think a lot of people have of what private detectives do. And what they really do is just exactly this. They go to the library, they go online, they do a lot of research and a lot of reading. That's really what a lot of the free world private detective is stuff. So again, we're kind of taking the conceit of the superhero universe and applying real world detective work to it and seeing what kind of happens as a result. And then at one point she's like, I'm trying to get audio. And so she goes to the library and it's like, I was wondering if you guys could turn off the firewall for a second. I'm trying to run a P2P client to file share some evidence, but between that and your janky net settings, it's not working. And so the librarian just stares at her and she's like, can't you help me steal some music off the internet? So she gets kicked out of the library. And so she runs into the same detective and it's like, it's you again. It's like, wait, I'm great. And not me again. And so she tells the detective the story of who this is, Mr. Brayson, and all of that. She has uncovered that his brother has actually been leaking these recording sessions on the internet, and so she's trying to track that down. And he's like, "Get out of my life! Get out of Los Angeles! They're tabloid freaks. Leave them alone." And the tabloid rings is a bell. It's like, tabloid, there you go. And so she gets on to what is known as the TMI celebrity tour, which is clearly a kind of an homage to TMZ. And that's a good – of all of the TMZ homages I've seen, TMI is actually one of the funnier ones. I dig that. It's really nice. And so she rides that to the Brayson home. And it's like, oh, look, it's Cher's uncle's house. This is exactly kind of sleazy, low rent, gossipy celebrity tour stuff. So she's riding that, and then she jumps off the back of the bus, changes into her outfits, and basically breaks in. And when she breaks in, she sees, again, the two men, bring them in the white coats. And she, they threaten her, and she's like, holy crap, it's Hercules, Iceman, Black Widow, Ghost Rider, and Angel. But why? It makes no sense. And then they look around, it's what? And it's like, oh, come on, Steve. And she, nothing going on. That is such a deep joke, and I'll go into a little bit more about that in episode 6. But Hercules, Iceman, Black Widow, Ghost Rider, and Angel were actually a team called the Champions that were based in LA. And the reason of why it makes no sense is because they were literally thrown together as just some characters that were sitting around doing nothing because Marvel wanted to make another team book, and it just didn't work. Champions are amazing, but awful, but amazing. So it's a nice little in-joke to Marvel history, while also playing the very obvious gag of, there's something behind you, and then she bails. So she goes out, makes her way out to the pool where she sees Mr. Bryson filling up the pool. And she makes their way into his studio, which is an indoor pool, and there's a piano sitting inside the pool. And this is a Justin Derber piano sitting in a giant waiting pool. And it turns out it was the very first Justin Derber, I'm not getting that right, but Justin Derber piano. It's the very first one. I don't know who made the waiting pool. But see, this is where I study my music. And then they go through the set of doors, and we see Wish, which is a room full of these acetone masters. And it's like acetone masters, which are they're like the vinyl records, but they're the original recordings. They're made on acetone, which can then be made copies of to make the vinyl replicas of. And so it's every second of every take of every session recorded since 1966. A big chunk of the 70s and 1985 were stolen and put on the internet. And she's like, none of them have labels. How do you tell? And he's like, I can tell. He just kind of glanced the side of it. And he's like, this is the horn section fanfare from the second bridge to Baby I've Got No Time to Run, recorded in May 8th, 1980. So he's clearly got something going on. He's not as addled as he originally appeared to be. So he talks about kind of the pressure of their family, who are also big musicians, and kind of how I pushed the brothers into it. And they kind of go into like, we had so much to atone for. We realized that this loving ideal of the 60s wasn't going to work. But then we realized that in the middle of all this love, that so much had been done. So much of it done that was wrong. And so he wanted to make a record that held both of these ideals, the idea of love and the terrible cost of it. And that was kind of the point behind Wish. But anyway, the two men in white coats show up, and the brother activated a security alarm. And so Kate fights them, does reasonably good job. There's a fighting in a waiting pool with a piano, which is very surreal. But eventually they do beat her up, knock her unconscious, and bring her before a man in a hospital bed, which is the brother. And she's like, did you steal your brother's music? And he's like, of course I did. It was my work too. It was my life work. Decades we were together, and he had this gift, this infernal gift, where he just couldn't quite make everything work. But we were sitting on so much of this music, and I need to get my own back, and I'm going to take him down with me. And so she runs into the guy in the grocery store again with the trench coat, kind of tells him what's going on. It's like, what can I do? It's like, they're just locked into this house together. They're driving each other crazy. And it was just too sad. And so it's like, she's like, I'm amazing at being a private detective, clearly talking herself up. It turns out he's like, you know, she's like, I don't really know what I did. And people can be so mean to each other. Kind of feels like, you know, nothing really is worth doing because everyone's just so horrible. And he hands her a flyer where Will Bryson's actually is doing a one night show where he's playing parts of Wish. And it turns out he's finally performing for the public again. And of course, the neighbors go because they're big, huge fans. And he's like, you may have heard this in your email or however that works. I don't know. But then there's a piece of trumpets here. But here you go. And he starts playing, and it's that same smile on his face that we have from the very beginning of the issue. And people are listening, and they're enraptured. And then a woman walks up behind Kate and whispers, "Found you," and then disappears. That's the end of issue 16. And then issue 18, we are onto Kate's kind of third case. She's riding her bike in the middle of the night, so she has a light on her forehead. She's going to the grocery store, and she runs into the guy in the trench coat, and he's like, "I'm leaving town." She's like, "What?" It's like, I just gotta go. So can you keep an eye on my cat? And the cat is a terror. She's covered in scratches and bandages, and the neighbor's like, "Oh, girl, you messed up." They're like, "We're taking the cat back." And so it's like, all right, well, they drive to the addresses on the carrier, and it's this huge mansion. And it's like, how can this guy who basically lives in a grocery store wearing a rundown trench coat be living in this amazing mansion? And they go up. And it turns out the door is open. There's a smear of blood on the door. And inside we see the place has been wrecked. And the man is covered in blood sitting on a couch. And he's like, "I'm going to die in this toilet." And he turns out that he's wanting to leave LA. He can't. And he was told if he ever tried to leave 22 years ago, he was told if he ever tried to leave LA, that they would kill him. And he talks about, you know, what's keeping you here. And it's like, it's supervillains. And he talks about the 90s. Our sodas were crystal, our t-shirts were hypercolor. And he was a reporter. And his report was the weird murder beat, you know, strange, unusual things, which in the world of superheroes is actually a pretty lucrative position. And he talks about, the raves and raids, the birth of cybercrime, European pop stars, and other monsters. You know, haha. But it's a fun little exploration of his psyche because it's going from these very kind of garish images to really unsettling ones. I talk about the color a fair bit, and I haven't done it in a while, but the color is fantastic. It really helps to sell some of these moments and really bring them to light or to find the right moment of darkness to kind of sell things. And he talks about he kind of obliquely mentions after the vampire stuff Hollywood called, kind of just glosses over it. And it's an interesting double play. One, vampires are actually pretty common in Marvel comics. Not like all the time, but vampires are a known thing. Dracula is a known character. He has a castle on the moon. It's a whole thing. But also, I'm personally acutely aware that the 90s also had the alleged vampire murders, which happens a couple different places in the US. And it was much like the Satanic Panic of the 80s. It was all blown up nonsense, but it was an interesting kind of glossing over of a cultural touchstone that probably people of Matt Fraction's age would be like, "Oh yeah, I recognize the reference." But other people, it's like, okay, well, that's a weird thing to just kind of skim over. But we had established that this is a guy who investigates strange journalistic crimes. So him researching vampires, not inherently weird. But again, it's an interesting little touch of culture. He's at a party. He runs into someone, Mr. Hudson. And he talks about a Count Neff and his daughter, Gia. Count Neff is kind of a loosely covered Count Nefario, who's an established Marvel villain. And there's talking about how everyone here is so young and fit and beautiful, and the publisher he's talking to is that Mr. Hudson's like, oh, how would you like to be that way? Just impossibly, you know, beautiful forever. And it's like, is it plastic surgery? Is it, you know, Botox, whatever? He's on the beach thinking about things, and he sees a man run by, and it's Hudson, who originally was an older man. Now he looks 26, and they're running, and he doesn't seem to be even breaking a sweat. And they go down to find a corpse. He actually talks to a friend of his who finds out that that there was a man that was killed, a semi driver who was burned beyond recognition. And it's basically what this is all pointing to is like kind of a body swapping story, right? And it's basically Neff and his daughter are actually Count Nefaria and Madame Mask. And they were basically trying to make copies so that they can replace themselves as needed. And again, we're playing with the vampire imagery, but this is getting more weird sci-fi stuff. And they found out that he was investigating them. They forced him off the roads at one time at night, and they beat the crap out of him, and they said, you can never leave L.A. And the image of the men beating him up are all the bellboys that we've seen associated with Madame Mask. Okay, we're going to, you know, they talk about, like, we're going to fly out, we're going to get you out of town. And they find out that his name is Harold H. Harold. That's all his plane tickets. Like, H, what does the H stand for? It stands for Harold. So his name is Harold. Which is just a great line. I don't know why that makes me so funny, but anyway, they're at a restaurant kind of getting ready for a plane start, and he is approached by the Weed Lord from issue 14. And it turns out he's there to kind of get the bellboys to come capture Harold H. Harold. Kate notices Flint, the Weed Lord, and starts to kind of jump in, but, you know, Harold's already been abducted. Weapons are pulled, fights happen, punching occurs, and they try to stop a car that he's being abducted in, and it doesn't work. We cut to the police station, the same police detective she's been working with, and she tells him all the stories, like, you know, are the Neffs, are they the Nefarias? And talks about someone comes in and talks to Detective Cottle, talking about the body they found, and like, you know, your friends, Harold H. Harold, left this for you. And so she starts reading this message left by Harold H. Harold. And we cut to her reading the message over what is very clearly Harold H. Harold's body, which has been kept hung from the H in the Hollywood sign. And of course, he talks about how he finally found his way out of LA with your help by dying. I thought of you, Hawkeye. Oh, sorry. She thinks from H. Harold, but it's actually from Madame Mask. How Harold found his way out of LA with her help. And so now I find myself one less playmate, one less game to play. And so now you and I have something in common. The only way you leave this town is in a body bag. And so Madame Mask is threatening her, and killing Harold was a message to her. So sorry about that confusing part. They're driving home with her neighbors. She's poking at something in her house, which book with, and she actually lifted Flint's cell phone. And so trying to get some data off it, but it's they're having trouble breaking in. And eventually they find out through the phone that the Nefarias are planning to kill Clint Barton. Because if you recall, way back in issue like one or episode one or two, the Traxxas Mafia met with a lot of villains to get permission to kill Clint. And Nefaria was part of that scene as well as Madame Mask. So she finds out through this phone that they're going to kill Clint Barton. And so she has to go home. And the very last page is they're driving up to the trailer and the trailer's on fire. So her neighbors their home is on fire. And that is where we will end this episode. So we're now at a point where Kate and Clint's stories are going to start to reconnect near the end here. We've seen all the pieces laid out and we're kind of slowly putting together. What I think is great about this series is that it shows kind of the dynamism of the comic book form. Like, part of the reason why we have this side Kate story is because, quite frankly, David Aja was struggling to keep those deadlines. And so they said, well, let's get a different artist to handle different issues and watch you start doing just Kate Bishop stories. And so we could do it every month to take the pressure off of David Aja to make sure he got his stuff done. And we end up with this great kind of side story. And it's basically just Kate versus Madame Mask, but that does eventually tie back into Clint's story. So it seems like it's a weird deviation, but it does come back around. And I will say, again, this is more of a personal thing, but I do like Amy Wu's art better. I think it's much more expressive. I think it's a lot less cartoony. And while it's still not level of David Aja's work, it's a lot better for me. And it sells better the slow decline of Kate kind of coming to the reality of her world. And there's context. She was a young Avenger for a number of years. But I mean, her life was basically, she was a rich girl, and she generally did fine with the Young Avengers. So she's really kind of seeing how perhaps the world really works through the lens of LA being weird. And it helps kind of put her in the same place as Clint, because Clint has also seen some stuff. So now she's becoming more like Hawkeye in a way. She's realizing that sometimes you just need to do the right thing, even if nobody else is behind you on this. Sometimes you have to do the right thing, even when everybody else is telling you that's a bad idea. And Kate's moving more firmly into that vein with all of these things that are happening, because she's seeing horrible things like what happened to Howard and realizing that someone should stop them. But LA can't do that. The way LA is set up, that can't happen. On that note, we'll kind of wrap it up for today. Next time, here in episode 5 is going to be issues 19 through 22, which is the end of the series. I'm probably getting emotional, just putting it out there right now. And then the last episode 6, I'll do recapping the series as a whole. And I'll also talk about some of the context, both prior to this with Clint Barton, kind of give some context for some of the references that maybe came out this and other things you can read if you like Clint. And then a little bit looking forward, in particular with Kate Bishop stuff, because not only is her Young Avenger stuff great, but also there's some stuff she's in the future, which I highly recommend. So that's the current run of Hawkeye. If you want to talk to me online about Hawkeye, you can find me on Twitter at Pugsteady. That's PUGSTEADY. You can go to my website. That's pugsteady.com. Or you can find me hanging on the Darker Hue Discord. So let me know what you think so far, and I will see you for the last 4 issues of Hawkeye next time. Take care.